Hey everyone, it's Steve Miller here in Washington. Thank you so much for joining me on Friday, July 1st for VOA's Asia Weekly Podcast. Now coming up in this week's episode, Beijing's Taiwan Affairs Office has stopped communicating with the government across the strait. So what exactly is next for Beijing and Taipei? After a week, we take a look at Brexit, the markets, and Asia. But first, South Korea is often held up as an example of lightning-quick growth in Asia, emerging from the devastation of war. But a recent murder in Seoul has many talking about a darker side of its society. For many, when they take a look at South Korea, it's a shining example of what can be achieved in a relatively short amount of time. Following the Korean War, the nation was destitute, suffering from the ramifications of two major conflicts. South Korea today has become a major economic force. It serves as an international shipping powerhouse and has effectively turned its music and television dramas into a hot commodity, which in turn drives tourism into the country. While South Korea puts its best face forward, there are blemishes on its impressive record. In May, a 23-year-old woman was stabbed to death in a public washroom in the Gangnam area of Seoul by a 34-year-old suspect who says he carried out the crime because he felt ignored and belittled by women. This past week, 22 men in South Korea have been arrested or face investigation for the gang rape of two middle school girls 5 years ago. And in another case, 8 high school students were sentenced to prison for intentionally getting a female student drunk and then gang raping her. And in Busan, the nation's second largest city, 2 school police officers have admitted to having sex with the very high school students they were sent to protect. There is, of course, no simple, all-purpose answer to explain why these things happen, whether they be in South Korea or anywhere. But speaking to me via Skype, James Turnbull, a freelance writer and lecturer on Korean feminism, who blogs at thegrandnarrative.com, broke down the current state of gender equality in South Korea.
If you look at the basic statistics, Korea has one of the lowest female workforce participation rates in the OECD. Overall workforce participation rates, that becomes important later. Sexual violence and crimes have increased dramatically in the last few years. The pay gap is one of the biggest in the OECD.
Expanding upon that is Michael Hurt, visual sociologist and a professor at Korea University.
If you look on the field of representation, women are still represented as objects for men. And I think the most important asset for a woman in Korea, which I think a lot of Korean people would agree with, is her physical appearance. But I think nowadays that people are looking at these kind of incidents with a different eye, people are much more willing to say, hey, that's not cool. Let's not blame the victim anymore. This is sexual violence. This is stuff that men shouldn't be doing anymore. So when these cases pop up, especially with social media and the internet these days, not only do more Koreans learn about them, but they get translated into news outlets overseas and picked up and sent across the world.
So what's different this time? What has stirred up so much outrage in South Korean society that a makeshift memorial was built near the murder scene, that people took to the streets in protest of these acts continuing to take place, and discussions about gender roles, misogyny, and equality permeated society? James Turnbull again.
Things have been coming to a head for 20 years in so many senses, but this was a random murder of a woman on the street who was just chosen because she was a woman. And this was what was the most shocking about the Gangnam murder. I do think it will be the catalyst for people demanding genuine change. And I do think that will be reflected in a more socially progressive candidate being chosen in the upcoming presidential election.
Michael Hurt provides a slightly more pragmatic view on why these issues are getting more attention.
Well, I think that Korean society tends to, kind of automatically put down this kind of outrage, right? This kind of embarrassing social kind of incident is something that generally is swept under the rug. But the thing that keeps it from being completely swept under the rug these days is the fact that once it reaches the spotlight outside Korea, that's when people start caring.
On June 22nd, the Busan Transportation Corporation, or the BTC, which manages the city's subway system, began experimenting with women-only cars during rush hour. The BTC says they're testing the program out to solve the problems that women often face with the growing number of passengers during peak hours. Chunun Hae told the Korea Times that she thought it was a good idea to create the women-only cars, and she often felt insecure when riding the subway because of the recent crimes against women.
I think the one thing that's always been true, that women have, you know, with good reason, a fear of men, fear of being sexually assaulted, because it's a real threat.
And the point that Michael Hurt makes is lost on many. Take Kim Dong-chun, who opposes the woman-only subway policy. He told the Korea Times that it wasn't fair for men to be treated differently because of gender, not even mentioning the women's safety concerns. This past weekend, China announced that it had cut off contact with the main Taiwan liaison body because of what it says was President Tsai Ing-wen's refusal to endorse the concept of a single Chinese nation. Taiwan Affairs Office spokesman An Fengshan said that contact had been suspended, dating back to Tsai's May 20th inauguration. Now, to get a broader perspective, I spoke with Scott Harold, RAND Corporation Associate Director at the Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. I kicked off our conversation by asking him, while it was generally expected that the tenor of China and Taiwan's relationship would change following Tsai's inauguration, well, how did things get to this level when just months ago, President Xi was meeting with President Ma?
I think that the basic and fundamental status of the relationship across the Taiwan Strait in a military sense is fairly stable. The trend lines are obviously still quite disturbing if you're sitting in Taipei, and perhaps quite heartening if you're looking only at the military option from Beijing's perspective. But in terms of the diplomatic or the informal relationship across the strait between Beijing and Taipei, I think what's happened is that Taiwan's election of a president who does not regard the relationship with Beijing as the same way as her predecessor and the same way as Beijing prefers to see it has led Beijing to try to impose substantial costs on Taiwan. It's not entirely clear that that is a strategy that has much likelihood of winning Taiwan's hearts and minds. It's quite difficult to think about convincing someone to like you by punishing them or making them suffer.
But I mean, if we take a look at the lines of communication, because, yep, you know, Beijing is now saying that they really haven't communicated with Taiwan since May 20th. Is that normal? I mean, is that something that we would have expected to see? Is this a sign that things are going bad?
I don't think anything has happened that is wildly outside the realm of the costs that many analysts expected China to try to impose. I think Dr. Tsai's positions have largely striven to give Beijing just enough wiggle room in its preferred interpretation to avoid crossing Chinese red lines or to avoid giving China an excuse to escalate. China has not seen fit to regard those efforts by the Tsai administration as favorable enough and is attempting to, as China, I think, is widely believed to do with many new administrations, is trying to enhance its bargaining or establish a maximalist position early on in the hopes that it can extract more and then see if it has to work back from that. Classic bargaining tactic in any society, certainly one sees a lot in China. But things that have happened that are a little bit more surprising, I would say, is China's effort to go around encouraging countries to send anyone who has been detained in those countries who is Taiwanese, encouraged those countries to send those individuals to China for prosecution. That's a relatively surprising, unhelpful development, not one that looks like really serves China's interests very much if it's concerned about Taiwan's.
But President Tsai is also wrapping up a 9-day trip abroad, seen by many as a way to shore up diplomatic ties with countries it has essentially relations with. Now, if you remember, back in March, China established formal ties with Gambia, which at one time had ties with Taiwan. So is that a factor in any way?
Gambia has sought to go back and forth and try to extract maximalist payoffs from Taipei, from Beijing. And when they severed ties in 2013 with Taipei, they thought they could then extract a big payoff from Beijing. Beijing surprised Gambia, I believe, by saying, no, we actually are holding up our part of this diplomatic truce with Taipei, and so did not accept and did not give any payoffs to Gambia. Now with Dr. Tsai having been inaugurated in Beijing looking to find ways to impose some costs, I think that was an easy way to simply say, okay, we now recognize Gambia's request to acknowledge or to shift diplomatic recognition. But remember, you know, Gambia is not particularly important for Taiwan's de facto existence as an independent, self-governing territory, space, whatever term one wants to use. And I think that in Taiwan, there's a recognition that the really important relationships for Taipei are with the United States, with Japan, with China on some level, with the Philippines, with Taiwan's immediate neighbors. It's certainly nice to have other countries around the world extend diplomatic recognition, but it's not worth chasing that and competing in checkbook diplomacy the way Taiwan had done in the 90s.
What about looking forward and the future of cross-strait relations, since that was such a big deal that kind of led to the KMT's downfall?
Well, I think the initial approach has been to think about ways that it can stabilize its relationship with China by signaling kind of a non-provocative stance, but not a stance that immediately gives China everything it wants. I also think that there's a belief in Taipei among Dr. Tsai and her administration that the best way to engage cross-strait is to first strengthen Taiwan domestically, strengthen Taiwan economically. And so there, I think you've seen them move to reduce reliance on China so as to reduce Beijing's ability to potentially coerce Taiwan economically and begin an approach that is premised more on outreach through what's called a southern strategy of shifting Taiwan's investment and to some extent its trade relationships towards ASEAN and diversifying them also through discussing the possibility of new kinds of economic relationships, including potentially at some point in the future maybe joining TPP. The idea here being that a Taiwan that is less dependent on China might be more able to negotiate with China from a position of greater confidence, and that would actually be a good thing for both sides.
Scott Harold is the Associate Director over at the RAND Corporation Center for Asia-Pacific Policy. Thank you so much for your time this week.
Oh, great. All right, Steve. Thank you.
Now, unless you have been stuck under a rock and actively avoiding the news, the headlines all week have been Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. Upon the announcement of the referendum's official result, the British pound hit a more than 30-year low and kicked off a whole lot of uncertainty in the world markets and questions as to what will happen next. To help make sense of all this, I'm now joined on the phone by VOA Global Markets reporter Jill Melandrino. Hey, Jill.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic. Okay, so here we are. It's been a week since the Brexit vote, and the markets really have been all over the place. And I want to ask you, has this essentially knee-jerk reaction finally stopped?
You know, it's interesting. We're just about 3% away from making all-time highs in S&P 500 and essentially flat on the year again. Going into trade on Monday morning, markets had erased all of their gains and the Nasdaq was in correction territory. The Nasdaq is actually outperforming major averages for a third day in a row, and it's also now out of correction territory. What's interesting is, despite the nice recovery that we've seen in the global stock markets, bonds have not really moved, maybe just a little bit towards the end of the session today, but they've really held their strong gains posted after the Brexit news, and their yields remain at all-time lows. So what I want to look for going into the end of this week is I think we'll continue to see sideways to higher trading. On Thursday, we're going to have what's called the end of the quarter. So we see what is window dressing in mutual funds, where portfolio managers will load up on stocks just to show that they have it on the books for the end of the quarter. So you might see a little bit more of upside action Friday is going to be a snooze fest. We have a lot of people who are going to be leaving the desks early because in the U.S. we have a 3-day weekend in observance of Independence Day on Monday. So I think when we come back to the trading desks on Tuesday, we'll start to see volume pick up again because we're also going into earnings season, which I think will be a nice welcome change for traders where we can actually focus on company specific news and not be so wrapped up in the macro day to day.
Now, what about over in Asia? I mean, has it just been essentially Forex losses? I mean, their markets were all over the place as well.
Yeah, well, they also caught a bit as well. We saw across the board Asian markets performing well. When we see extreme periods of volatility in global markets, investors tend to flock to safe haven assets like gold, the yen, the dollar, U.S. treasuries, and that is exactly what happened following the Brexit vote. The Japanese yen ETF, the ticker symbol for that is FXY. It's an electronic traded fund, or what's referred to as an ETF. With the FXY, it tracks the price of the yen. If you take a look at the 5-day performance of the FXY, we can see it is up just over 5%, which is quite a return.
Well, yeah. I mean, the yen has really been surging. I mean, I remember being in Asia and being in Japan, and the transaction rate for the yen was abysmal against the dollar. And here it is back to that magic 100 number or so.
Right. And the more expensive the yen is, the more costly it is for Japan to participate in global trade. This is why we're starting to hear more about the currency wars, particularly with the yen and the yuan, as their respective central banks scramble to keep competitive with foreign trade. The Bank of Japan, they've been noticeably absent from the market thus far. There has been virtually no commentary. Certainly the likes of Japan's auto and vehicle parts exporters, crude oil refiners, exporters of computer and computer parts, they've got to be dismayed that the government has done nothing to dissuade the yen from strengthening. But perhaps the BOJ is waiting on the release of the next Tankin report, which is on Friday. That's going to be a key piece of data for them to see whether or not they're going to do anything with the yen. And quite honestly, I don't blame the Bank of Japan for taking a step back and seeing how global markets are going to play out. Just because you have a blip in your currency or the stock markets, to rush in with central bank intervention is not always the best policy. I mean, again, if you would have done, let's say that the Federal Reserve had intervened when we were down 2 days in a row on Friday and Monday, it made absolutely no sense. Why inject more uncertainty into the market when we virtually have come back, maybe just a few points here or there from this last Thursday's high?
Well, what about, okay, sticking with Japan and the Bank of Japan and the strong yen, Japan has that negative interest rate. Could this affect how long the Bank of Japan wants to keep that around?
Well, if the yen continues to move as high as it has been, what they're going to do is they're just going to continue to buy more bonds. And that's going to push down the rates even more, the yields even more. And I think that's one of the reasons why the U.S. market has been pretty resilient. I think we are seeing money come into U.S. assets because there's so much uncertainty in the U.K., and in the Eurozone and in the Asian markets. I just don't think there's much confidence in terms of what the central banks are doing. And I think that's part of it as well. But you will see in extreme times of volatility, everybody rushes to the yen because they know that it's going to be propped up.
One last question. Speaking of cooler heads prevailing, Article 50 hasn't been invoked by Britain yet. Will we see a similar reaction once that is fired off?
I think what you're going to see is a continuation of the way markets were trading up until the Brexit vote. And you're going to have some stability, a month, couple months, and then you're going to see pockets of volatility where Article 50 will be triggered. And then you'll see the initial reaction, it come back into balance, then the next issue will come up. So I think that's really what we're going to see over the next couple of years. Almost like when we have a Federal Reserve interest rate hike meeting, we get that volatility up into the event, we have the initial reaction, things kind of fizzle out until, for the next 6-8 weeks while the Fed goes through its analysis process. So I think that's most likely what we're going to be looking at, in the intermediate to longer term.
All right. Joe Malandrino is VOA's global market reporter up in New York. Thank you so much for helping us out this week.
All right. Thank you.
And that's going to do it for this week. But you know what? The conversation doesn't end here. So please hit me up on Facebook or Twitter. Just look for Steve Miller VOA and let me know your thoughts and opinions. And also be sure to join our community Facebook page. It's VOA Now. To get the podcast delivered to you automatically, subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast application. It's quick, it's easy, and best of all, absolutely free. Well, thank you so much for joining me this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.